This is the Comics Alternative, the world's smartest comics podcast. Episode 306, reviews of Now number 5, Criminal number 1, and Scratcher numbers 1, 2, and 3. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Comics Alternative. I'm Derek.
And I'm Sturge, and we're two guys with PhDs talking about comics.
And on this episode, Sturge and I are going to be looking at three titles, and we're going to begin with the latest Now issue coming from Fantagraphics. That's number 5. After that, we're going to look at the first issue of Criminal by Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips, at least the first issue in this manifestation of Criminal. And then we're going to wrap up by looking at three issues of John Ward and Juan Romero's self-published Scratcher. But before we get to that conversation, we want to let all of you know that this episode of the Comics Alternative is brought to you by the good folks at Discount Comic Book Service. Go to their website, dcbservice.com, for all of your comics pre-ordering needs. There, you're going to find all DC, Marvel, Image, and Dark Horse titles at 40% off of the cover price if you pre-order. For all the other publications, you can find that those discounts will be anywhere from 20 to 35% off of the cover price. And every single month, you're going to find some unbelievable specials. Sometimes those specials could be as much as 45% off the cover price. Sometimes 50% off cover, but every now and again you can find discounts that are even more impressive than that.
That's right, Derek. And if you go and look right now to order, you can order the last two issues, Now number 4 and Now number 5, which we talk about today, both for 35% off. And Criminal number 3, which will be coming out in the near future, you can order pre-order for 40% off.
You know, you just can't beat the great prices at Discount Comic Book Service, if for no other reason, because discount is in their name. Go to dcbservice.com. They will take care of all of your comics pre-ordering needs. And after you do get your titles there, please be sure to send them an email and tell them that the two guys with PhDs sent you.
That's right.
Well, let's start off by apologizing. Last week, we did not have an episode, and that's on me. I had some scheduling issues with other things that I had going on in terms of my work, and we weren't able to get an episode out. But the things we're going to discuss on this week's show, the one we're talking on now, is the what we were going to talk about last week. So, in essence, you're not missing out on anything.
That's right. We will fulfill all your alternative comics needs.
That's right. Yeah. So please come back.
That's
right.
Thank
you for doing so, folks.
Thank you. Come again. See, I did that without the bad accent.
Yeah, good.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's go ahead and begin by looking at Now number 5 out of Fantagraphics, and this is edited by Eric Reynolds, and this originally came out in December of last year, and We usually are pretty timely in talking about Now, but over the holiday season and then into at least the first part of January, there were a lot of things we wanted to talk about or needed to talk about. For instance, like our end of the year show last month and our look at the latest American Best comics. Mm-hmm. And as we always do. So we needed to talk about that. That took up time. But we wanted to get around to talking about Now number 5. Kind of like on our last regular review episode, we looked at the latest issue of Love and Rockets, which had come out last year as well. But the thing about Now and Love and Rockets that they have in common, outside of the fact that they're both published by Fantagraphics, is that we have more or less made a public statement that we plan to review and discuss every issue of Now that comes out, and then every issue of Love and Rockets that appears.
And they keep putting them out, so that's good for us.
That's good. Yeah, it's a great Conversation Fodder.
Mm-hmm. And there's a whole lot of different stuff. I mean, this issue was, I don't know. I feel like since before I started co-hosting with you, I feel just out of touch with a lot of artists and a lot of people. So now I really appreciate, because it introduces me to lots of people that I had no idea were out there.
It does. It does. And in many ways, this is like the Great American Comics volumes that come out every year, the aforementioned one, you know, Great American Comics volumes mm-hmm. by Houghton Mifflin.
That's right.
Houghton Mifflin Harcourt.
Edited by Greek fella, Bill Cartolopoulos.
Yeah, or the general editor, yes.
General editor, yes.
Yeah, did you guys, Greeked out last That's time we had him on the show?
Opa!
But, you know, you can always count on those volumes, just as in now, to introduce you to people in the comics world, or sometimes it's not even so much comics. It could be just the creative world. I know mm-hmm. with the 2017 volume of Great American Comics, which was edited by Ben Catcher, one of the things that was so standout about that book was the fact that Catcher's, I guess, conception of comics was rather broad and I think challenging to the reader. And so he introduced things that people normally, I would at least, normally think of as comics. And I think the same can be said of Now. The kind of contributors that they get on every issue of Now, it's very different comics. Definitely what you don't usually expect when you think of comics. And, I mean, there is a list of, I don't want to say usual suspects, but mm-hmm. of regular contributors, right? That yeah. we get. Theo Ellsworth, I know, has been in one or two previous issues. So has Roman Muradov. Jose Quintana. This is the second appearance of Walt Holcomb. Mm-hmm. And then we've had others whose names seem to appear familiar, like Galvanas. Maybe I'm wrong there. I know Karen Katz was in a previous mm-hmm. volume of Now. But they have a lot of creators that they keep bringing back. But with each issue of Now, they're those plus new people. And right. so it's like their stable continues to grow.
Yeah. And I even think that the people that are repeats are not, they're, you know, they're still fairly, you know, towards the beginnings of their careers, I think, or at least I haven't seen a lot of their art. And I think that there's kind of I get the sense that there's promoting, you know, certain voices that are kind of out there and vital and creative right now and kind of, you know, cycling back to them when, you know, they have a new piece or something else that's interesting to go in here.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, I mean, I don't know the ages of the various contributors right. or how long that they've been in the quote-unquote comics world, but the one that seems to have been around the longest, at least in this volume, is Walt Holcomb,
mm-hmm.
because he has older work. And, I mean, other names that are the contributors in this latest issue of Now, number 5, that I recognized before was, you know, Theo Ellsworth was one. Maggie Umber, I'd seen her work before.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Quintanar, mm-hmm. I had. And then, you know, there are one or two others, maybe. Oh, definitely Muradov, Roman Muradov. Right. I've read his work before. But outside of that, I would guess that most of these others are relatively new to the field, or at least they contribute work perhaps locally wherever they are. And they may have been doing that for a while, but I just haven't had access to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I feel the same. I feel the same. Like, I appreciate seeing all these things and, you know, kind of having them all in one package. Because there's people like, yeah, I don't know. They don't – I don't really have easy access to following all these people all the time. So I'm glad to get this kind of package and, you know, kind of get some familiar ones and get introduced to lots of new stuff too. Even though some of it's more challenging than others, especially in this issue, I felt more so than you know, some of the prior ones I've read.
Yeah, that's a good point. On the topic of challenging, mm-hmm. Maybe that could be an interesting segue for us in terms of discussing the contributions proper. Mm-hmm. I said contributions proper instead of stories proper, because with some of these, especially the more challenging ones, I don't know if the word story applies.
Yeah, I agree with you. I was trying to think about what, you know, what about this kind of hit me different than some of the other ones? And I think that at least for, you know, a number of them, not all of them, but like you said, I don't think that there's so much there's not so much caught up in portraying a narrative as they are kind of, I don't know, maybe some creating some kind of aesthetic space and just kind of having you experience the art in it. And it's not so much a story, you know, that's just more kind of creating, I don't know, lines and colors and trying to, I don't know, have it just be kind of an aesthetic, just something right. that you kind of go through for a little bit instead of a story that you follow.
And I think the best example of that in this issue of Now is DW's Paper Collar.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I agree with you there. On, what's that? On page 22.
Yeah, it's a five-page quote-unquote story. And I put the word story in qualifying quotes because on the surface, I mean, if you just look at it real quick, it's a beautiful work.
Right.
It appears to be a comic that tells a story because you have, you know, various panels, one next to the other, with these images. And the images have something in common, or a few things in common. I mean, most of them have some kind of circular image right. somewhere. Not all of them, but most of them do. And then there's a creature of some sort. I don't know what the hell kind of creature it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of lizardy or iguana-y sometimes.
Sometimes it looks like a fish, maybe. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
Hardly any words in the various panels, but it appears to tell some kind of story. I don't know what the story is.
Yeah, I agree with you too.
But that's okay. And I think the way you put it earlier, how did you put it earlier? More contributions or expressions, visual yeah. expressions than stories proper. But I think that that's the best example of that kind of comic in this issue of Now.
Yeah, because I mean, especially on page 25, there's lots of references. There's one about a Florentine from his palace. And then at the bottom, there's something about Aztec priests. And to me, it's almost like, maybe portray the unportrayable or some kind of higher thing, maybe. I don't know, yeah. like maybe a deity or something like that.
I looked at it as more of a series of visual themes
mm-hmm.
than yeah. anything else.
Yeah, I could see that. I could see that. I mean, because the last page of it kind of really, you know.
It's different, stands out.
Yeah, it does, because that to me looks kind of like a – like, I don't know.
Page 26.
Yeah. On page 26 looks, you know, some of those art pieces are in there and there's kind of like a cat. It looks like a cat and kind of like, I don't know. I think that looks like a dinosaur to me, like a duckbill dinosaur. But then all around it kind of looks like to me, you know, these kind of really primitive shapes. I mean, to me, they call to mind, like, I seen some sketchbooks of Gary Panter's mm-hmm. and that kind of like really yeah. kind of primal, you know, striking, you know, almost like primordial kind of image where, you know, it's they're clearly animals of some sort, but they look like they're hybridized with human heads some a little bit, or right. you know, they got cigarettes, they're drinking coffee. I mean, there's
sitting
lots
of one sitting on top of another animal. At first I thought that was a table, but no, that's another animal.
Mm-hmm.
Smoking a cigarette, drinking coffee, and illustrating something.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, that takes it to a different place too. You know, maybe this is like the artist sitting at the table creating what's come before.
And then there are more what I would call traditional type comics mm-hmm. in this collection. And more times than not, those are usually shorter pieces.
Yes, yes. Almost like gags, some of them.
Yeah.
I would say.
And in fact, you know, there are a number of longer pieces here. I don't know. I didn't go in terms of preparing before the show, I didn't go back to my previous issues of Now and see the number of longer contributions in those compared to number fives. But I would venture to guess that there may be more longer contributions in this issue of Now than there have been in the previous four, or at least I just had that feeling as I was reading number five.
I get the sense of that too. I agree with you because I think for the other ones, there'd be like maybe two or three long ones. And there were a lot more shorter pieces. And this one seems like there's at least five long ones. And, you know, that's they're little numbers. But with this many pages, it's definitely noticeable.
Yeah. Now, Theo Ellsworth, who opens the volume or this issue of Now is one of the shortest. It's only one page.
Right.
I think he had a one pager in last month's or the last issue of Now, number four, didn't he?
I think you're right.
Yeah. And this one, Demon Earth Goddess. Which is, again, you know, Theo Ellsworth playing around. He's really good at creating monsters and weird creatures.
Oh, yeah.
In a very detailed, swirly times way.
Yeah, and the coloring makes this work very well, too. Like, it's, you know, it's almost like primary colors, you know, green, blue, red. And with all the swirls and things, it definitely, you know, that, you know, it's very expressionistic, I would say.
Yeah. And then there are a couple of shorter contributions at the very end of this issue of Now. One is, I think, an untitled story by Darren Schuller. And Darren Schuller is someone whom I think has been in previous issues, one or two of them at least, of Now. Has he not?
I think so. I think so. I couldn't find his name, but his name is very familiar to me.
Yeah. And this is a funny two-pager. This begins on what?
124.
And it's just a fun story about a kid eating some cereal, reading some comics from the newspaper, and he laughs at them. He gets cereal on his fingers. That stickiness, milkiness, or whatever he's eating, you know, kind of gets mixed up and starts smearing the ink at the comics that he's reading. And then also the ink gets on his fingers. And it starts affecting him. The colors go into him. He becomes, you know, turning cartoony in ways that are like the cartoons that he's reading from the paper. And then as he becomes comics, the comics that are on the table become him looking back at the cartoon character that he's become. It's really fun.
Yeah, I liked it. I thought it was very clever. It was kind of like a palindrome of a comic strip.
Yeah.
And I love the colors. The colors are just garish and crazy and, you know, like kind of like, you know, Sunday comics, like the classical kinds of things. And yeah, that I just but they're kind of it's funny, but kind of horrible, too, because it's like those panels were like he's kind of warping after he's absorbed all the colors and it looks like his face kind of melts into like the comics. And it's a little bit. That could be played as grotesque.
Yeah, it is. And the comic character looking down at him at the very end, and he appears trapped. The young boy becomes trapped. I mean, there is something a little horrific about that, but funny at the same time.
Yeah, and I agree. It's like it's just like Fruity Pebbles or something like that. They're fun yet horrific at the same time.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. And Schuller's art here is very like newspaper comic-y. It has that kind of fun, wacky feel to it.
Yeah. And the backgrounds are like, you know, those polka dot curtains that are in the background, you know, that's something that's just, you know, something that, you know, like a comic like Nancy would have something like iconic yet, you know, striking kind of in the background. It's just kind of that form that kind of frames the whole thing the whole time. Or not the whole time, but much of the time, you know, just a detail like that. I really, you know, I really like that. I thought this was one of the more fun things in the book. You know, the only thing that could have been more fun is having a talking hot dog in a comic strip.
Yeah. And that leads us to another short one at the very end of this issue.
See how I did that?
Now that's very good. Jesse Reklaws. I'm not sure how you pronounce the name. R-E-K-L-A-W. Reklaw. Reklaw.
I go Reklaw.
And this is titled Short Story, right? Is that?
That's what it's called.
Yeah. It's apparently a piece that was written a couple of years ago because we even have the date here that Reklaw put it on. And basically you have a disgruntled, smoking, talking hot dog. And this is a three-page story where this talking hot dog basically goes from one situation to another. Like on the first page, some kids are asking him for money for some cider. And at first I thought they meant apple cider, but apparently they mean the kind of cider that's alcoholic.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's they're trouble. That kid's got an anarchy sign on his shirt.
And then next we see the hot dog going to the bank. Then he goes into a bar. Then he goes where? I know he goes someplace else. I guess he's still at the bar.
He's at the bar talking.
But they talk about various things, right?
Yeah.
So it's not like a cartoon with one long conversation.
Yeah, right. It's various different things. And I think he's talking about somebody eating hot dogs. You know, they're full of carcinogens.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's a funny one.
Mm-hmm. I like that one, too. Anytime. Well, anthropomorphic food is fun.
Now, yeah, anthropomorphic food. You know, one of the ones that impressed me is outside of Ellsworth, the piece that starts this issue.
Okay.
And that one is DRT's Blue Dax.
Yeah.
This is one that is, now, have we seen the work from DRT in previous issues of Now? I can't recall.
I don't think so. I don't think I've seen DRT before. And I don't, I was trying to think. Yeah, I haven't seen it in anything that I've noticed or that I'm recalling.
Yeah. And I have no idea who DRT is. So I don't know what kind of gender pronoun to use. You know, he, she,
right.
They.
I'm going they.
Okay, we'll just say they. I mean, this is a weird story and an impressive story, or quote-unquote story, in a variety of different ways. Now, if you're wondering what the name refers to, and it, by the way, it's spelled B-L-O-O-DAX, D-A-X, Blue Dax. We get some information about what Blue Dax may be at the very beginning or toward the very beginning of this contribution in the foreword. Through the mists of time, through the haze of clouds of the cumulonimbus where their wonder blue, the daughter of none, son of none, ever searching for the stone of truth across the vast fells of Boo wonders, listening for the stone. It calls to Blue, but the blue is faint. I mean, I'm sorry, but the call is faint, as though it too is shrouded in the mists of time.
Oh, yeah. I love the lettering in there, too.
It is. And then on that next page, we find out where the word Dax comes from in Blue Dax. Blue comes from the clan of Dax. And apparently, the story that we have here in this issue, because it kind of looks like a comic book in certain ways, is titled, this adventure is titled Blue Bill Bear and the Stones.
Mm-hmm.
It has the look of an old comic book, you know, where the colors have been faded through time.
Right. Or like an old picture book to me, too, like those images.
An old picture book.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, on the topic of an old comic or an old picture book, I mean, the interesting thing about Blue Dax is that what DRT does here is to take the various pages of, you know, what could have been a book or a comic. And it's almost as if like a kid has cut out the pages, but they don't do it in a straight way. So in many cases, you can see the bottom of one page from the previous page. Or the side of one of the pages that we have here in Now, a little off in terms of how it was cut and laid out.
Mm-hmm.
So it just struck me as something like a kid may do, where their scissoring hasn't been that neat.
Or it looks like an excerpt from a broadsheet, like one of those, you know, classic kind of Sunday comics, you know, those really large, you know, pieces of paper. But yeah, like you said, they're not cut evenly. So like you see hints of what was below, actually mostly below. I don't think there's much above. But yeah, it's kind of like you're in the middle of everything all the time, which kind of gives it a nice, what I liked about it, like you get glimpses of a thing, but it's almost like there's incomplete parts too. Like a lot of the artwork seems like on page 11, like you get Blue Dax's figure, but you know, there's parts of it missing. And then there's all these, you know, kind of cubes that kind of fill in the background from the bottom going up towards the middle and, you know, kind of fill the space in an interesting way with kind of geometry. And I kind of felt like that throughout this, you know, it was almost like in a nice way, like a comic book archaeology, like, you know, it's kind of like we got like a tablet or a fragment of a story, which kind of gives it, you know, maybe this added mythic weight for me, at least, you know, like you think about like, you know, classic texts or things like that. Like you get a tablet and it's about, you know, some kind of hero or warrior or god or something like that, but you don't have the whole story and you kind of have to piece together, you know, what it means or what's going on you know, and it's kind of like, I don't know. I love how the lettering kind of makes it seem kind of impressive too. Like, you know, the mighty Blue Bill Bear, which kind of seems silly to me. Like there's a silly aspect to it too, yeah. Right?
Like the mists and mists of time.
Yeah. Like there's all these things that these are supposed to be impressive.
Yeah.
But
also the incompleteness that you were referring to just a second ago seems to underscore the kind of, I guess, aged tone, visual mm-hmm. tone that we get in this contribution.
Yeah, and I agree. But that's all kind of counterposed with like the imagery, which seems very like comic. And I would even say, you know, a lot of it seems kind of manga-ish to me with like, you know, the kind of blood spurts and, you know, all these kind of lines. I don't think that they're supposed to be necessarily motion lines, but, you know, it's kind of like a, I don't know, it's got a lot of different kind of aesthetic styles going on to me.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned the manga. I hadn't thought of that as I was reading this story, but it does seem something about that. I mean, what I think you may be referring to are on pages, what, 15 and 16?
Yes.
Where we have, I don't know, this character, I can't remember the character's name if we get it at all, and then a big pop
right.
with a sound effect image behind it, and this character's arm explodes or pops off or something,
mm-hmm.
and it looks to be blood spurting from it, and we get kind of a repetition of that on page 16 after we first see it on 15.
Yeah, and then what follows seems like this kind of weird battle with the bear. You know, and on page 18 where it's like flail to the heart, you know, that's like one of those that reminds me of one of those like older kind of kung fu comics where like, you know, they announce their move while they're making it like, you know, like bear punch or whatever.
Right. That is. Oh, character's Blue. Of course, that is Blue's flail of fury.
Yeah. There you go. See, when you got moves like that, that you have named, that's impressive.
Okay. Yeah. But that was a fun piece.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And it had. Had a lot going on, and I love how it ended. You know, watch out for the next installment of that strange glowing berserker, Blood Dax, or Blue Dax.
Blue Dax.
Yeah, Blue Dax, which I, you know, I would read more of this, but I kind of get the feeling this is a one-off kind of
who knows, tone maybe thing. In a future issue of Now, we'll see Blue Dax again.
Hey, I can hope. I'll have the first appearance. I'm going to put this in a Mylar when I get home. Yeah.
Other story stood out to you in this issue Now?
There are a couple that were kind of strange. I mean, one of the ones I really liked was right after Paper Collar, that Anna Galvan, is that how you say her name? She kind of got a tilde on her N. So I don't
Galvas?
No, it's G-A-L-V-A-N, but with a tilde on the N.
V-A-N. Okay, I misspelled it on my notes.
So Galvan? But that tilde is like Galvan. Is that like a Y? It's like a N-ya.
Yeah.
Galvan. I'm saying it horribly, and I apologize. But I thought that one was clever, too. That one was called Selection Process.
Right?
Yes. And it starts with like that weird geometric shape. You know, it looks like it looks like just kind of random pixels on a purple background. And, yeah, and then it kind of turns into this weird, you know, woman in a tube walking under this little door that she has to crawl through. And, you know, through like this weird landscape. And then ends up at a job interview on page 32. And I don't know. I've always hated that sensation. And to me, it kind of captured that kind of paranoia, uneasiness, anxiety. You know, the coloring is just kind of weird pastels thrown together, which it just seems like not natural.
Yeah, kind of like an interview process.
Yeah, kind of like, you know, fluorescent lights. Like, this definitely seems like, you know, you have to crawl, go underground. There's these weird noises. It just seems like they're messing with her, too, which is funny to me. Like, it's one of those things that I always suspected in the back of my head. And then, you know, at one point, the interviewer walks away and leaves the notebook on the table. So the interviewee, of course, looks at the notebook and it's blank. And she comes back and she's like, what do you think you can make fun of me? And, you know, and then like a bell goes off. It's like, congratulations, you passed the first test.
And these characters, and these are, I guess, coworkers with balls for heads, it looks like,
yeah,
come out with balloons.
Oh, yeah.
That's supposed to be some kind of celebrations of congratulations.
That's right. And then she gets the, and her reward is she gets to go back through, she gets to crawl through that little doorway again and come back tomorrow and we'll continue.
That's right. And another fun thing about this story is that after we get her coming from the tube and crawling through this, what, window door thing, whatever it is.
Right. It's like a dog door.
Yeah. This page basically is the ending of the story.
Right.
Where she, you know, the woman who's interviewing her says, thank you for your time. I'll see you out. Tomorrow we'll continue the selection process. Mm-hmm. And then the interviewee says, thank you, gets on her hands and knees and crawls through this, what, doggy door window thing.
Yeah.
Out into the street. And because we're wondering, well, what's going on here? What just mm-hmm. happened? And then we see on the following page, what, 31,
right.
This young woman, or who appears to be the young woman who just crawled through the doggy door again, walking down a street, and then she's at a job interview, which begins on page 32. And right. then she goes through the process of the interview, which becomes a little strange because, what, two or three times she hears humming and doesn't know what it is and suspects the interviewer of creating that sound to distract her. I mean, it's really weird. Right.
It is so weird.
And then at the end of the process, you know, I guess this is on page 40, mm-hmm. we get a repetition of what we saw several pages earlier with
right.
the interviewer saying, thank you for your time. Tomorrow we'll continue the interview or the selection process. Mm-hmm. And then the interviewee saying, thank you, gets in on her hands and knees, crawling out of the window door thing.
Yeah. And to me, it's, you know, like I'm glad you said that. It kind of starts how it ends. And I think that's a feature of a couple of the comics in here. You know, they're kind of more, I don't know. I call the other one like a kind of weird palindrome, but you know, they're kind of that way to me, or at least I felt that way.
Yeah.
And you know, I like that one a lot. What else?
The one that follows that, and this is Maggie Umber's The Damon Lover, Damon, is interesting because there's a story there somewhere.
Right.
But at first it's not entirely clear what's going on. And this is fascinating because it's not really black and white. It's more brown tones.
Right.
For the most part, I guess brown and gray, brown and gray tones.
Yeah.
And at first it seems like a series of almost photograph-like images of lovers.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not entirely sure if the woman in, or even the man in these various images are the same. They may or they may not be.
Right.
So we see just a series of men and women together. It seems like they're in love, either younger or older. And then after that, a series of images where there appears, I guess, to be some kind of story of a woman waking up, having coffee, getting dressed, going to see a man with weird eyes.
Oh, yeah.
And then coming back home, taking a bath, putting on different clothes, realizing she doesn't have anything to eat, goes to a local drugstore, it's coffee counter, and then comes back home, comes into her house, and that's it. But I mean, there's a story there.
Right. Yeah. And I wondered about that. I didn't know if that was her house or if she went back or went looking for whoever that, you know, she's got a business card. So she's looking for that writer.
Yeah.
James Harris. And I didn't know if that was, you know, she went up and looked at his place and his place is gone. Like it's empty and barren.
That's a good point. Yeah.
And I didn't know. And it has this, you know, for me, it kind of had this old, like classic Hollywood noir feel too.
Right. Yes. Yeah, it's like images that could have been created in the 1940s or 1950s.
Definitely. And it, you know, it feels like, and she looks like, I don't know. I'm not good. Like Lana Turner-ish maybe.
Yeah. And I thought about that. And at another point I thought maybe she looked like a Lucille Ball type character.
Yeah.
I mean, not too silly.
Right.
Because, you know, Lucille Ball was a very attractive, striking woman.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, she wears those kind of floral dresses. She's got her hair kind of like interesting, but there's these kind of squiggles that go through, and I couldn't realize if they were flowers or something else. And you know, knowing the title, I was like, is she the daemon? You know, is there, you know, she some kind of, I don't know, creature that preys on different, because on page 45, you know, it looks like a wedding. The page uh-huh. or 44 looks like a wedding, but then that image on the bottom of 45 looks like the suit is different. It might not be the same guy, but that looks more like a funeral to me than it does, or like a body kind of in state, than it does a wedding thing. And I don't know if, you know, she's bedding him or if he's dead. And I was like, oh, and then, you know, the next page, I was like, is that the next guy?
Yeah.
You know, like it's that kind of, you know, like a noir in a way, like, you know, the, you know, I'm not saying that this is how I view the world, but a lot of those noirs, like the women are kind of like these,
femme fatales.
Yeah. They're femme fatales, but they're like succubi or something. Like they come in and they get what they want and they take what they want out of this poor schmo and then they ditch them.
Yeah.
And they go on to the next one. And, you know, I thought I was, you know, it brought a lot of that to my mind, which, you know, is good. Cause this is, I don't know, to me, this is another one of those like tonal ones, because like you said, it's like, I'm trying to make a narrative out of it. And I don't know if it is a narrative or if it's just a, you know, one kind of tone, you know, trying to evoke, you know, maybe noir themes like that, or get you to think about the things that we've kind of been talking about.
And perhaps one of the things that Umber is doing here in this piece is challenging our understanding of what is story in comics, or even the fact that, you know, our assumption is, at least mine is, that all comics, or at least the vast majority of comics, should have story. And usually we read for story, but maybe we shouldn't. Maybe, you know, as we were talking about in terms of Paper Collar by DW, that it's more of a process of visual association, visual themes, visual leitmotifs. And maybe that's more of what comics should be.
Yeah. I mean, and you can read it counter too, where, you know, because those guys with that, those creepy eyes, I mean, maybe that's the daemon, and maybe that's, you know, it kind of did the reverse of what you expect in a noir, and it, you know, leaves her with nothing at the end, which, you know, usually in those movies, it's the woman who does it to the man. But in this, maybe it's the counter example. I don't know, but it's puzzling, and it's beautiful to look at. It's like you said, it looks like watercolors maybe, but not colored, you know, like browns and grays and, you know, very, you know, one tone, but, you know, definitely, you know, there's different washes on the pages and things like that.
You know, one of the things I try not to do whenever I look at an anthology, and we discuss it on the podcast, is to talk about various contributions as like the best.
Oh yeah.
And so I usually frame it in terms of my favorites. I have to say, in this issue of Now, and all the contributions are incredible. I think in every issue of Now. I mean, you can't go wrong by picking up Now. So that's our recommendation to you, dear listener. Get every issue of Now, because we will.
There's only five. It's a piece of cake.
But my favorite contribution, hands down, in Now number 5, and this is on page 97, and that is The Asshole with the Hat by Walt Holcomb.
Yeah.
Now, one of the reasons why I like this is the second issue in a row of Now that we get a contribution from Walt Holcomb. And as I think I mentioned last time that we discussed Now, you know, several weeks ago, maybe a couple of months ago, I can't remember when it was that we did that show. But that was the first time that I had seen anything by Holcomb in years.
Right.
And it's I don't know if he's been inactive over you know, more recent period of time, and now he's become more active. I don't know. Maybe he's been creating the whole time. I just haven't been aware of it. But I know that what was that comic that he used to have? And I think we referred to it last time.
Oh.
I don't know. Yeah. But this one's funny, and in many ways it's, I guess, autobiographical, because Holcomb is the asshole with the hat, as he says at the end. And basically, this is a piece about how much he loves hats and the benefits of hat. It's kind of a love letter to hats. He even gives us on page 100, a brief history of men's hats, talking about different kinds of hats, a little bit of hat history, some of the purposes of hats, how hats have evolved over time. And now, you know, in a more contemporary period, what people think of hats and the reputations of hats and those who wear hats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I'm wondering if – I'm just doing a little bit of digging around. There's a Wikipedia page – not a Wikipedia, an IMDb page, and there's a bunch of animations with somebody named Walt Holcomb involved with them, and maybe that's what he's been doing, because there's a bunch of credits for, like, Adult Swim-type cartoons, like the Mike Tyson Mysteries and something called God Hates Cartoons. Mm-hmm. So maybe he's been doing that kind of thing instead. Because his art is, I mean, definitely, you know, it looks like it would be well suited to animation. Like, they look like cells almost to me. You know, mm-hmm. very strong lines, you know, bright colors, kind things like that.
Yeah, really fun looking stuff. In fact, yeah, that piece has the brightest coloring of any piece in this issue of Now. And in fact, if you want a great introduction to Walt Holcomb's work, I mean, you could get issues number 4 and 5 of Now and see that, or mm-hmm. you can get a collection of his 90s work called Things Just Get Away From You.
Yeah.
Which is really, really good. I haven't looked at that in a long time.
Yeah. But
yeah. I mean, this is a fun piece. Another reason why I like it is because, like Holcomb, I'm a hat lover. I have a lot of different hats. And then, in fact, at one point, God, where was it? On page 100.
Right.
Where he gives us the history of hats. There's a list of different kinds of hats over time.
Right.
And then toward the bottom of that page, there's a strip of various kinds of hats. And I'm wondering if he has these hats.
Right.
He doesn't mention this, but he names the kind of hat, the maker, and the year. Sometimes the maker, like Biltmore, which is a hat maker out of Canada. I mm-hmm. know I have at least a couple, I think 2 or 3 Biltmore hats. They're wonderful. They're like the, I guess, Canadian Stetson, but I think that they're classier. There's the Biltmore Maples Felt that from 2006. Mm-hmm. The Turn Cloth from 1963. The Checked Cloth Cap from Britain, I guess, in 1912. The Pork Pie Cotton Straw, and I'm partial to pork pie, by the way. Mm-hmm. So Pork Pie Cotton Straw.
You look good in a pork pie hat.
Thank you, my friend. And then a straw boater from 1905. Mm-hmm. I've always wondered what I'd look like in a boater.
Well, we might have to figure this out. We need to get a haberdasher, like stat.
Mm. Yeah, anyway, I was wondering if these are hats that he owns or hats mm-hmm. like these. And I would have liked for him to give us a list of what hats he has.
Yeah. Well, this is something we need to find his. He's got a Twitter, so I think we should tweet at him about what kind of hats he gets.
Or
hats.
Yeah, hey, show us your hats, Walt.
Show us your hats. He's got an interesting kind of – it's like a historical-looking image going on right now. He's looking at
account?
Yeah, his Twitter account. He's looking at masks or he's looking at sculptures about which cultures he prefers. And he prefers Assyrians much more than he prefers Minoans or Egyptians. Mycenaeans are okay.
And Holcomb has an incredible sense of humor.
Yeah.
You know, it's just kind of wacky at times. Also, it's a little self-defacing when he writes about himself. And he even mentions that's his sense of humor, and he likes to wear hats that reflect that.
Yeah,
because at one point fairly early on, he makes a distinction between, I guess, what you would call dress hats or more dressier hats mm-hmm. and fun hats.
Yes.
Which is the kind he likes to wear. I mean, he likes to wear dressier hats too, I would assume, from the way he writes.
Mm.
But yeah.
Yeah.
Tells us the kind of hat that he likes to wear, and it says something about who he is as a person.
And I love this too, because this is more like an observational kind of strip. And I just love all the different things that he kind of brings up. Like on page 99, there's that woman who sees him and says, you look good enough to eat. He puts a little asterisk, real event, obvious lunatic. Like, you know, very self-deprecating. Yeah. Like this woman's crazy. And I mean, and for me, this is just a random detail. But on 101, there's a picture of Curtis Armstrong in Better Off Dead, which is one of my favorite. It's a horrible John Cusack movie that I love.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, you know, how the hats are like a symbol of the dandies and kooky oddballs right. from TV.
But Ian. Jaunty. Jaunty is the word that he likes to use for the kind of hats he wears.
Yes, he is a jaunty fella.
And, you know, about the jauntiness, one of the things I strike, in fact, on, what, 102, the very first yeah. panel, he says, I've aimed for the jaunty with my look, plus a hint of 1950s jazz musician. I know. And he gives us a list of various jazz musicians that seem to have, I guess, the kind of hat that he likes to wear, because they right. seem to look like his hat that he has throughout this piece.
Right.
And one of the things I noticed is that the jaunty look apparently is where you have a hat where you don't turn down the front brim.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it be a fedora or a pork pie or what have you. I mean, there's some hats where you can't turn up or down or turn down or not down the front brim. You know, it depends on my mood as to whether I will wear a brim up or down.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes a difference. And he apparently likes the up, more jauntier look.
He likes it.
Like with a Stetson, for instance, you wear the brim down in front, and it gives you a more formal, serious.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. In fact, speaking of formal and serious, one of the, another thing I really loved about this piece is we get a guest appearance from Seth.
Yeah. Well, who else wears a hat and does comics, right?
Exactly. Yeah, he Holcomb says at this point, and this is on what, page 101, whenever I see someone with a hat, especially an artsy type, my first impression is one of solidarity. And then he sees a guy coming down the street who wears a hat, and by this point we can make out, is that Seth? And then Holcomb's character points to Seth coming toward him and says, "Who's the asshole with that hat?"
Yeah. And then when he finally gets close enough, he says, "Nice hat." And Seth yeah. tells him, "Sorry, I don't have any change." It's horrible. And you know what I actually like too? There's a lot of things about this I like him kind of thinking about what he actually looks like, him comparing what he thinks he looks like versus what people probably think he looks like. Like, you know, a stew bum or a night soil man or a chicken thief cornered in a barn, you know, in various times. And this woman says, "You look like a 1950s math teacher." And he's like, "That's pretty good." But at the yeah. very, very end, there are credits. Like he has, like, you think this he is just a fun toss up thing. Exactly. He tells you where the hats are all from, the references, which is
where he got the information. Yeah.
Oh yeah. And some of the imagery maybe even. So I was like, that's, I dig that.
So I have to say that that's my favorite of this whole issue.
Mm-hmm.
The second favorite is what follows.
Ooh.
The asshole with the hat, and that is Walker Tate's nail clippers.
Uh-huh.
Now, I can't recall if Tate has been a contributor of Now in previous issues. Do you know?
Everything I looked at, I haven't seen his name, so I don't think he has.
Okay. I don't even know if I've seen Walker Tate's comics before. There's something familiar about it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not exactly sure. It has a Chester Brownish kind of look.
Yeah.
Or at least early Chester Brown feel to it. I don't
yeah.
know. I mean, I don't want to be reductive and say, oh, his work looks like, you know,
right,
Chester
right.
Brown, his early work from Underground. That's not necessarily the case. But this is a strange story. And I guess it gets its name from the very first image we see on the first page, 104,
right.
which is of nail clippers on a nail.
Mm-hmm.
What appears to be nail
tied to it.
Top. Yeah, exactly. I'm not entirely sure what this story is about, although everything that goes on in this piece seems to take place in an office of some sort. We don't know exactly right. what kind of office. It's an office that accepts gifts from sponsors, and then they use those things that the sponsors send them in order to, I don't know, do whatever, and whatever they're doing has something to do with food and cooking. Yeah. So maybe they're food critics. We don't entirely know. I mean, there's a lot of information, tons of information that's not given here, but it's all fun. I mean, it opens with one of the people in this office standing by the window, and he looks outside much of the time.
Right.
He says, "Did you repair the can opener?" And then there's a guy unpacking a box in another place in the room who says no. And then a guy who's on the phone, the guy who's unpacking the box says, I guess, to the guy with the phone, "Tell the sponsor that the provided appliances are defective."
Mm-hmm.
And so the guy on the phone says, "That's what I'm waiting for." And so he keeps waiting and trying to get the sponsor to tell them the information.
Right.
And so there are problems with the material that they've gotten in the box. And one of the problems that runs throughout most of the piece that I think is hilarious is that their sponsor uses mulch as a packing device.
Yeah.
So that the appliances or whatever they're sending doesn't get damaged in any way, but the mulch is infected by ticks.
Yeah, or termites or something.
Was it? Is it ticks or termites?
I don't know. They got big jaws. I don't want them around in either case.
It's something like that, because then they infest the office.
Right.
Or the premises, whatever this
place. Oh, yeah. And I think that's one of the things that's interesting about this comic is that, like, all the words are very open-ended and weird. Like, nothing specific. It's the premises. It's the spot. Like, you get no names. You get all these kind of abstract, they're not names, but these abstract nouns for everything. And that space, that office, looks like the worst office ever. I mean, there's nothing in that office in the background. Like, there's a table, but everything else is Spartan. It just looks like a whole lot of empty space with like a bunch of random boxes and dudes sitting around talking to each other.
Yeah.
And there's nothing in that place. And it's like everything is open, like literally just kind of blank and empty, like from the terms to the artwork. And it's just like guys standing around and then just, you know, bugs coming out of telephones.
Yeah. Whatever these creatures are. And then another thing about that is they make a sound.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Right.
And so you hear this or see this sound throughout, let's say, the last two thirds of this piece.
Yeah. I felt itchy reading this one like the whole time. I was like, is there something on me? Is there something around me? Because all those little, that sound effect being everywhere and just trying to, you know, think about it. I was like, this is just creepy in a way.
Yeah. I mean, I felt infested reading this piece, but that's part of the fun of it. Another, I think, fun part of Nail Clippers is that it ends kind of in an abrupt, ambiguous manner.
Yeah.
One of the guys leaves the office to contact the sponsor in person because he can't get him on the phone.
Right.
And he walks away. We hear the sound, and then we get a series of images, or there's a tree, and then one of the guys who's still inside looking out the window, or at least someone behind him, says, "The sink is clogged."
Yeah.
And then we get an image of a mousetrap breaking what seems to be glass, I guess. Right. And then the tree that appears in some parts of the story has been cut down. I mean, it just ends kind of weirdly. But then again, this is a weird story.
There's a lot of like echoing, I think, because them looking through the window or the door. Actually, it's looking through the window. So they're using the mousetrap to kind of look like the window. But then there's all these images of like people looking out at the tree, that one guy looking out at the tree. But then when you see it from the outside, like on page 109 at the bottom right panel, you see the tree shadow and it kind of hits the window in a way that it looks like the tree shadow is the guy. So, like, the guy is the tree in a weird way.
Yeah,
like, you're right. Reflected.
Yeah, that's a good point. That example and then the one that you mentioned about the window and the mousetrap, I hadn't even thought about that earlier when I read this, but a repetition of image or image layout, I think is important.
Yeah,
and the thing with the tree, another thing is earlier there was one occasion, this is on page 106, I think, where we see the tree from the outside and there appears to be a guy in the tree and he's making that sound.
Yeah.
It's like, what the hell is that? But no other place do we see a guy in a tree. We see a guy looking at a tree.
Right. But even the panel prior to that, you know, the guy looking at the tree, it looks like the line of his head reflected in the light kind of is like the tree is kind of like his hair.
Yeah.
Even though he doesn't have hair. But it's like, what? Like, I don't know. It's like everything is kind of just melding into one thing, like in a weird way.
Yeah, this is a fun piece.
Yeah, definitely. I agree. It's got lots of it's got lots of ambiguity and lots of repetition and lots of, I'm just like, it's like eye candy in a way, because you're just trying to look at all of it, kind of digest it, figure out how it all makes sense. And maybe eye candy is not the right way, but it's something fun and visual.
Eye weirdness
is something. It's, you know, and I think that's kind of a hallmark of this issue. There's lots of this that's like confounding in this book. And interesting, though, not confounding in like a frustrating way. It's just like confounding, like in a, like, you need to read it more than once. You need to read it more than twice, you know, and it's rewarding to do so, I think. Or at least I felt that way.
Well, we probably don't have time to talk in depth about every single contribution in Now Number 5, but which other ones really stand out to you that you want to discuss a bit?
I really liked, what page was it? Right after the Damon Lover on 62, the Cabin.
The Cabin by Aaron Franklin?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a fun one.
It's kind of like a woman walking through a house. The woman's in black and white, and the house is kind of various color. It's a very, you know, it's not monochromatic, but it's close. You know, like the backgrounds are blue on the outsides, and then kind of in the house is more, you know, yellow and orange. And it seems like she's kind of having a nervous breakdown in a way, or she's ruminating on the past.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is one of those stories that is longer. I think it's about something 13 pages long. And all the pages are set up in the same way. It's interesting that you started off talking about the color, because that's how all the pages are laid out. Mm-hmm. What consumes the entire page is this bluish image of this character doing something, and then inset within that blue image are smaller panels of this woman doing things. And more times than not, what's in the blue background image has something to do, at least apparently something to do, with what she's doing and the dialogue that she may have in the insets that are, you know, reddish, orange, yellow colors. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's a little harder to figure out if there's an association between the inset images and then the background blue larger image. And it's interesting in terms of the inset red, orange, yellow images.
Yeah.
She's telling a story, or she's telling a story or describing things about her life.
Yeah.
But many times what she's saying in those inset images are different from the images as opposed to the words themselves. And so I read this story at least a couple of different ways. I went through and I read the image and words at the same time, the first time I read the story. And then I went back through and I quote unquote read only the images inset in the larger blue images. And this may sound a little confusing to those who haven't seen the story, but it is a rather complex piece.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't know, because it's like you said, she's talking, but she's talking about the past. She's talking about past relationships. She's talking about her life, you know, and she's also, you know, there's some playful things in here. And I don't know if she's having she's having a breakdown or something, but she's definitely troubled. She seems to be living in like this. It seems to be, I mean, it's called the Cabin, but this looks like one of those little like tiny houses that people live in. You know, like self-contained on the outside. On page 63, you kind of see it in its totality. You know, it's out in the wilderness. There's this little cabin. There's a couple gardens nearby where things are growing. And it seems like, you know, that kind of maybe somebody trying to simplify their life. Mm-hmm. And,
triangular.
You know, yeah. It's not a really complicated house. It's kind of just like an A-frame, right? Page 68, I love that too, though, because this is kind of counter to everything else, because most of the thing is her talking about the past or kind of talking about space and touching the house. But on page 68, I love it because, you know, that blue image, she's kind of just out in nature imitating nature. And it just kind of cracks me. Like, I love, you know, like there's a broken limb and she's kind of bending her arm the way that the limb is broken. You know, there's these little plants with like rolled up leaves and she rolls her tongue up like in the style of the leaves. Mm-hmm. and the flowers are sprouting.
Yeah. And there is a little story that's going on here. As she's telling us about her life and her likes and what may have happened in the past or whatnot, you know, it begins with her outside doing something, maybe taking a hike, experience in nature, coming home, washing up, taking a shower, washing nature off of her, then making dinner, eating dinner, then after dinner, going out for a walk, which is what you were just describing, her experience in nature, the tree, comes back, plays around at her garden or by her garden wall, then looks at her garden, then comes back into the cabin. And that's where things get a little more abstracty.
Yeah.
It's almost as if she does have a love affair with her house.
Mm-hmm.
It comes in, lies on the floor, kind of feels it. And then toward, I think, the very last page, we see her, looks like she's in, I guess, one of the windows. It looks like a window.
Right.
And she's pressing out with her hands. She licks the sill. Then it looks like she's outside walking down.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not exactly sure what she's experienced. She slips. And then there's that final image is one of either her hanging upside down or almost one of ecstasy.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing. Like, she keeps putting herself in different spaces in the house. Like, at one point there's, you know, her dishes are all dirty and she's like, oh, the dishes are all dirty. And then she's like, oh, do I fit in here? So she goes into like the cabinet where all the dishes were. And she's like, I do. And, you know, it's like, she's just kind of experimenting with the space in a way too, like just trying to push her body into places and seeing if it fits. And, you know, and maybe it's kind of a, you know, some kind of weird elaborate metaphor, maybe not elaborate, but, you know, trying to find your space in some weird sense. I'm getting real literal.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much to like about this issue now. I mean, stories that we haven't even gotten to yet. Roman Muradov's Rain Check is a fun one. Not that long, but it's a great visual piece.
Right.
Jose Quintanar's Strawberry Chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
A collection. I think not one story. I think a series of stories, the longer one being toward the end. You know, the guy – the main guy, I can't remember if he has a name, who meets the fella who's carrying a cross, who has a cloth over his head. And that's where Strawberry and Chocolate comes from, that piece, because there's reference made to Strawberry and Chocolate.
Yeah. There's some weird Larry Bird basketball stuff in there too.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So that's a fun piece. Karen Katz's inspection of shopping carts, I think, is, really intriguing.
Yeah, I like that one a lot myself.
Like I said, so much about this issue of Now, but then again, there's so much about Now worth reading.
That's right. You should check it out.
Okay, let's start talking about the next contribution on this episode of the podcast, and this is Criminal Number One, written, of course, by Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips. This came out on January 9th from Image Comics.
That's right, and it's kind of a return to what they had done prior, I think, in the second series, more standalone stories, so you don't really have to know what's gone on before. Just to kind of enjoy or catch on. Although if you are a reader of Criminal, you will recognize some of these names and some of these characters, and you kind of get that.
It may be a standalone piece. We're not sure, because now this is an ongoing series, a new Criminal ongoing, and it's not limited, I think. But maybe this first narrative arc will be a Teague Lawless story. There could be, like in the second issue – that we'll get next month may kind of pick up where this one left off. I don't know. Well, I want to talk about the ending of this.
Okay.
Because I don't think it gives anything away. We'll get there eventually. But from the end, I wasn't sure if the second issue will pick up from that or not. But I would guess that this first narrative arc may, or it may not be, but it just seemed to me that it may be a Teague Lawless piece. And, you know, Teague has been in a variety of other Criminal stories, longer and shorter. I know he was a big part of Last of the Innocent, Wrong Time, Wrong Place. He's also been in a variety of earlier narratives, not necessarily as the main character. So, for instance, in Lawless, that was all about his older son, Tracy.
Right, right.
And Tracy was also the subject of Sinner, correct? That storyline.
Yes, you're right.
Yeah. But yeah, you're right. We do get many of the same, I guess, criminal world characters that we see. The main one here is Teague Lawless, his son, younger son, Ricky. And we see Sebastian Hyde, who is a big, you know, criminal in Central City. And there are references to other criminal places and characters that we've seen before.
Right, right. And the second issue will have Archie Lewis. So it's not going to, it's going to jump around.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And that's because I had read something about what they plan to do with it. And they wanted it to be more standalone issues. And I don't know if they're going to return. Like, I'm not sure what they're doing, but I can't imagine we're not going to see people again and again. From just looking at what's on Comixology, Criminal 3 will be a continuation of number 2, but I don't think that they're all planned to be, there's no plan about just standalones or series with this one. I think it's just what moves them to kind of tell as a story.
Yeah, and this is a great issue of Criminal, a great way, I think, to start off this new ongoing series. It's a long piece, and you know, this is one of the things I love about Image Comics is many times the first issue is longer.
Right.
I mean, not in every instance, but in this instance, definitely. The main story itself, I guess the only story, I say main story because what follows is something that you usually get from Brubaker is, you know, some essay in the back of some sort. But this story is, I guess, about 35 or so pages long, 35, 36 pages long. And we have a series of events, and one seems to lead to the next, to the next, to the next. And so by the time you get to the ending, you've kind of lost, or I kind of lost, where the story started off. And I was just fascinated by that. We also have a couple of embedded narratives in this story. The first embedded narrative is the story of Sal and Mac. I mean, Mac and Sal. Mac is an older guy now who had been a wrestler who then stole some jewelry in Japan, and he was known as Mac the Monster when he was a wrestler over in Japan. He had a friend, Sal, that he got involved with in a variety of different ways. And then the second embedded narrative in this issue of Criminal is the story of Arvin Burns, who we learn dies, and then Teague goes to his funeral. But before the funeral, we get Arvin Burns' story.
Right.
Yeah, it's just, I think, a fascinating way of an example of storytelling that we get in this issue. But then again, I come to expect nothing less from Brubaker and Phillips.
Yeah, and I agree. It's very complex. It's multiple storylines, multiple timelines even. I love how, you know, at this point, this is, I think, their sixth series, if we count the – or maybe fifth, sixth, or seventh if we count the – what was that? My Heroes have always been Junkies.
Yeah, which we looked at late last year.
Mm-hmm. And this is, I mean, at this point, he's got a really complex world peopled with all these characters, and they all have their stories. And I'm just impressed with how much detail and how much nuance he kind of has and how he's able to kind of weave them all together. Because like you said, there are at least three major stories going on in this one thing that, you know, not all of them feature Teague.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting to me to kind of get that kind of amount of reading. I mean, I love it. This was a very rewarding issue for me because, you know, it's self-contained, like you said, a 35 page, you know, tale, but it just felt like a lot more to me because there was just so much going on in here. Mm-hmm. And I'm really glad this is back. And if this is going to be like this, I mean, it's kind of a high water part in the series for me, which is crazy for me to say because the whole thing is just kind of been a series of high water marks for me.
Yeah. And the narrative point of view is a detached third person narration. In places now in like some of those embedded stories, and I'm thinking in particular the one of Mac and Sal.
Right.
When we get Mac's story, now even that is told from a third person point of view. Although we know that Mac is repeating the story to Ricky, who he thinks, Mac thinks, Ricky is his grandson, Philip.
Right.
Because Ricky, it starts off with Ricky breaking in to Mac's house to steal a diamond necklace that Ricky knows that Mac has. Mac, who's an older guy who's kind of losing it a little bit in terms of his awareness of the world and time, thinks that Ricky is his grandson, Philip. Mm-hmm. And then Ricky plays along. And then, you know, he's caught trying to steal the necklace. And then he wants to know more about the necklace in order to get out of being caught. And so Mac tells the story. But apparently this story of Mac and the necklace is something that other people in the community know.
Right, right, right. And it's like maybe some kind of unspoken, infamous thing.
Like a legend.
Right, right. Because yeah, when Ricky goes to fence it, he really can't.
And then when T goes to Arvin's funeral, we mm-hmm. get a story of not only Arv, but of Teague's relationship with Arv and what that meant to him.
Right, right. And even that's not, I mean, that's, it's like the classic kind of noir thing. Like, there's no joy in any of this.
You know? No, there's not. You know, now speaking about the lack of joy, I want to get to the ending that I referenced earlier. And there's something I really do love about this. Mm-hmm. And I don't think this is giving anything away narratively at all.
Right.
Really. So no spoilers are going on here. But toward the end of this issue, T comes to realize that his next job might be something that Arv may have been preparing for before right. he died. I mean, he doesn't know. But we do realize, and as usual, things aren't going well for Teague. He just doesn't have the best of luck.
No.
But on the very last page, we get like a big one-page image, and then the narrative boxes inset within that image read this way. Maybe things were finally starting to turn around, he thought, Teague thought, not really believing it. But Teague was right. Things were about to change for him. In a few months, he would fall in love for the first time in his life. And by next summer, he'd be dead. His brain splattered across the wall. Across the wall.
Yeah.
But he didn't know about any of that right now. No. Right now, he was just a man making a plan, counting the money in his head. One of the things I love about that is we get this kind of narrative prolepsis, or at least forward flashing in a bit, or referencing of what's going to happen to him that the main character, Teague, has no clue about.
Right.
What's going to happen? How's that going to play out? Because I think in previous criminal narratives, we may know, at least in some stories, that Teague is dead, but we don't know the circumstances of it.
Right.
And we're not given any clues about that here.
Yeah.
I mean, we do get some information about him falling in love for the first time, so I want to find out more about that. I want to, in the next issues, I hope we get something about, even if they're not about Teague, about who this woman is that he fell in love with, and then what happened that caused his death.
Right.
I mean, I don't know if we will.
Right. And yeah, that's one of the things I love about this series too, because, you know, if we're talking about the now issue, not having not being driven a lot by narrative. Criminal is, all narrative in a way, mm-hmm. multiple narratives kind of woven together in interesting, you know, ways, but even with spoilers, or, you know, that's a spoiler in a way that, you know, narrative, you know, the author telling you that this guy's going to die, but it's still intriguing.
But we know in earlier stories that he's dead.
Right, right. But it's intriguing. And it's like, you know, it doesn't take away, you know, a lot of people talk about narrative and like, it's like, I don't want to know what happens because it's like it cheapens the experience in some way. But I don't think it does that at all, especially if you have a masterful storyteller who can keep you in suspense and kind of, surprise you with the details and the nuances and the things that they have kind of imagined in their story that do not match up with what you're expecting at all, in good ways, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, it sets up certain expectations.
Yeah.
It's like, ooh, I wonder if we're going to find out more about what happened to Teague or who the woman was that he married, and we may never know.
Right. She's got to be some piece of work, knowing Teague.
Yeah, and maybe, I mean, you know, maybe the thrill of wanting to know what happened, specifically what happened to contribute to Teague's death, is something that Brubaker is always going to be postponing.
Right. Yeah, maybe. I mean, that'd be hilarious, actually. Yeah. You never meet her.
Yeah. Now, you know, of course, another striking thing about this issue of Criminal is the art. You know, Sean Phillips does excellent work. And the colors here are done by Jacob Phillips. And I think that's Sean's son, right?
It is. Yeah. So now it's like the family business.
Yeah. And I know that Jacob has colored before with Brubaker and Phillips. And I think he does a fine job here. Mm-hmm. I do have to say, though, that visually things looked a little different than earlier Criminal stories. And the colorist on many or most of those, Elizabeth Brottweiler?
Yeah.
Who is an outstanding colorist.
Yeah. Yeah. She's the hard act to follow. You're right.
And I think that maybe Jacob is experiencing that hard act to follow phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, but still the colors here are fine.
Yeah. This is, I mean, I will buy anything that they do.
Yeah.
I've never been disappointed by anything that they've done. In my memory since Sleeper. Or maybe, what was that, Scene of the Crime? That might have been the first one I think I read of theirs.
Yeah, that Vertigo story.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, and not only will I buy, you know, almost anything that Brubaker and Phillips do, especially larger collections. Usually with their series, I wait for the larger collections to come.
Sure.
Like, I think I bought the first couple of issues of the Fade Out, but then I held off until, actually, not only the trade, but the deluxe came out.
Right.
And I got that. You know, but I'll also get the individual issues, all the individual issues. I'll probably do that with Criminal for this reason. Not only do we get the stories, but we also get the pieces that, whatever they're about, that Brubaker contributes at the very end. And you won't get those in the collection.
Right, right. Yeah, and that's what's nice about this, too. Go ahead.
Here at the end of this issue, we get a very brief essay about, or at least the first part of it is brief, where he talks about the return of Criminal and what he and Sean Phillips had been doing before, why they wanted to return. And then he goes through a series of the Criminal collections that are already out, you know, starting with the first the storyline, Coward, then Lawless, then The Dead and the Dying, The Bad Nine. And he tells us just a very little about what goes on in each. The Sinners, The Last of the Innocent, Wrong Time, Wrong Place. And then the latest text within the Criminal world, My Heroes Have Always Been Junkies.
Right.
That we discussed last year.
Yeah, and I appreciate getting that. And following that, there's a review of Blood Simple. If you've seen that movie and want to read it, you can do that too.
And again, these are the kind of things that you don't, these final pieces toward the end,
right,
what we don't get in the collections, whether they be paper or deluxe.
Yeah. And I mean, that's the thing that I remember starting, I think, with those $1 comics a long time ago. Like, I think, what was that book called? It's a Casanova, that $1 book. I forget that. I think Fell City.
Casanova?
Yes.
Okay.
It used to have like a letters page or something in it that it was the thing that he wanted you to buy it for. Mm-hmm. And Brubaker did that, I think, with the second series of Criminal. And I mean, I think Sex Criminals did it too. Like their letters columns, like people like those. They ended up publishing some of those, I think, separately.
Oh, yeah.
Like as you know, I think they just call it like the words or something like that.
Other creators do something similar, even if it's not with essays, I know, or letters. You know, Matt Kent, in his various stories that he've told, like Mind Management, I think is a perfect right. example. But he does this in other series that he's created, especially, you know, for either Dark Horse, Image, or what have you. They include something about that issue that you won't find in the collections, whether it be images or layouts or what have you. So for instance, with Mind Management, the back image of the first several issues created a picture. If you put the comics together on the floor and pulled back and looked at it, which is something that you did not get in the collections
right.
of Mind Management. And so I appreciate it when a creator or a creative team does something in individual issues of their comic books,
mm-hmm.
you know, that makes it worth getting instead of just trade waiting.
Right. Yeah. And I think, like you said, they're trying to incentivize the floppies. That way, you know, you want to buy them and get something out of them that you can't get out of that trade. And I don't know. I find myself doing a little double dipping anyway. Like, I'll buy certain series. Like, I like Criminal a lot, so I might buy the trade as well. I think I have every trade of Criminal, and I have a lot of individual issues. So, you know, it's maybe not every series, but I do find myself buying sometimes I'll buy a digital version of it. That way I don't have to store it. Yeah. But then I'll buy the trade. If that makes sense.
But this first issue of the new Criminal ongoing series is just incredible. I was blown away. I can't wait to see what comes next.
I agree. It's a great debut, and you know, I'm on for the ride I was on for the ride anyway, but this is like exceptionally well done.
Okay, let's look at the last title that we're going to be discussing on this episode of the podcast. Mm-hmm. And this is something that we rarely do. We look at a creator-owned title, actually something that someone contributed to us via email. Now, let's just say that many times we get creators who self-publish or have something coming out, usually from smaller presses, mm-hmm. and they want us to know about it, and they send us an email, and they, I don't know, attach some images. Sometimes they'll attach a PDF of the entire, let's say, first issue, and we take or give us a link to where it can be found. So they tell us a little bit about it, and the vast majority of the time, even if it's interesting stuff, we usually don't have the time to discuss it on the show. And one of the things that, at least when I read the emails, that makes an impression is if the email sounds as if it's kind of just generic, something that they've sent out to a variety of different people, okay, that's fine. I thank you for alerting me to your comic.
Right.
You know, more times than not, I'll reply and say, thanks, we'll take a look, we appreciate it. But like I said, 99% of the time, we don't discuss it on the show.
Right.
This one, though, we got back in, we were alerted to this title back in late December of last year.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the first three issues of Scratcher, written by John Ward with art by Juan Romero. And this is self-published, but I guess Arbutus Comics.
I think it's Arbutus.
Arbutus Comics. And this is, I guess, Ward's doing, because he has a website, www.artibusfilms.com. Mm-hmm. And if you go to /scratcher, then you'll see what these issues are. So that's Arbutusfilms.com, and that's ArbutusFilms.com/scratcher, ScratcherAnd so anyway, he introduced himself to us and told us where we could find the first three issues of Scratcher. Now, the first one came out in April of 2017, the second one, issue number two, in April of last year. And then late last year, I'm not sure exactly when, maybe around the time that John emailed us. So that would have been about December,
right,
of last year. Issue number three of Scratcher came out. So this is an interesting series. What are your initial thoughts?
I mean, I thought it was interesting too, knowing that he is a TV writer and a movie maker, because I think it's Arbutus Films. You know, that makes a lot of sense.
I think he also has a podcast.
Yes, I think he might be right. He's also got a black belt in fondue, according to his website.
And he's a PhD.
That's right, in string theory.
Yeah, geez.
This guy, I mean, I feel, you know, I usually feel like, I've done something. But this guy, oh, man, I'm slacking. But, yeah, it read like a TV or like a really interesting kind of TV miniseries to me. But not in a bad way. Just it felt it felt episodic, like cliffhanger-ish. And the concept, like the setup concept, is like a great kind of hook for, I think it would be a great hook for a series, honestly. And I could talk a little about that. It's about a woman named Dee, who is, you know,
she's one of the main characters.
Right. She is one of the main characters.
Yeah.
But it starts out focusing on her. She is a tattoo artist. And it turns out that something is going on with the tattoos or the peoples that she's tattooed, and the tattoos are coming to life or shifting around and taking influence on people. I don't say it's taking control, but it kind of drives them all crazy to the point where they just start murdering folks and doing horrific things.
Well, it's weird. I mean, you're right. But I think it's each issue is even more different than that.
Now, I agree.
The main setting, I think in all three issues that we have so far, is the tattoo parlor that Dee works at, which is called Floyd's.
Right.
And so that's where Scratcher comes in, right? Mm-hmm. It's not as if this is a comic about tattooing.
Right, it's not.
In some ways it is, but I think in more ways it's not. But because it takes place with a variety of characters that are associated with Floyd's, you know, the most prominent of which is Dee, but there are other characters who are a part of it as well.
Right.
But so I think but that's why it's called Scratcher, because it deals with what goes on in Dee's world, or, well, Dee and other characters. I know the first issue, the main character seems to be Sarah, because what happens is that Sarah has a problem where there is something about her that causes these growths of some sort, hairy growths at times, on other people, in some cases causing death. And we're not exactly sure, at least I wasn't sure, what was going on. But there's something, some kind of condition that Sarah had that caused this problem. And so I guess the way I read it, the main relationship in issue number one of Scratcher is Sarah, or Dee, of trying to avoid Sarah because of what Sarah does. But we also saw in many times, Sarah's effect on other individuals, both the tattoo parlor and elsewhere.
Right.
And so I don't know what kind of monster-ish situation is going on in that issue. Now, in issue number two, things are completely different. Now, we still have the same context, I guess, in terms of setting, and Dee's the main character. Mm-hmm. But the a main character in issue number two is a young priest who has a tattoo called Jerry.
Right.
And Jerry appears as some kind of, I guess, werewolfish kind of creature. I mean, he doesn't turn. I don't know what that means, but it's very monster-like. I mean, these are horror stories of one form or another that are based in the world of this tattoo parlor. And then in the third instance, a main character is named Lucy.
Right.
And it's kind of vampiric, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But it has something to do with tattooing and the relationship with Dee. And so in each of these characters, we have, you know, the similar context of Floyd's parlor and various characters that crop up here and there that we've seen before. But the situation in each issue is very different.
Right. Although there's this other character who seems to be trying to capitalize on the horror. And there's like I forget his name, but he's got the dreadlocks, and he helps Dee deal with Jerry in the second.
Oh, in the third issue, you mean? Or is it the second?
It's the second one. It's the guy with the van that looks like he's got the dreadlocks. What is his name?
You know, I was trying to figure out his name.
Yeah.
I couldn't find it. Maybe I wasn't looking well enough. And, you know, and I'm sure that I'm hoping at least that John's listening to this. I mean, we really like these three issues of Scratcher. Thank you for sending them to us and telling us about what you do. We're having fun discussing them on this episode. One bit of advice, though, is with the naming and the characters, both visually and also in the dialogue that takes place, especially fairly early on, be very clear, be unambiguous about who is saying what.
Mm-hmm.
And So there's that example. We get this dreadlocky guy.
Yeah, I don't think he's got a name because
we ever get his name. But we see him often enough in the second issue where he should have a name of some sort. Mm. And then a thing that got me a little confused at the very beginning of the first issue is in that very first panel, someone says, "Jesus, D, how much longer?" Now, we realize later that it's Sarah, but we don't find out Sarah's name until we're into this first issue. Now, I'm not saying with exposition, just throw everything out at the very beginning. Definitely don't do that. Mm-hmm. But make sure. And also, the D that we have here seems to look quite different from the D that we have later in the series, because here D doesn't have that kind of short hair.
Well, she cuts it off because at the very beginning, the Sarah pulls her ponytail out or something.
That's right.
So I think it was proactive.
Or she has to cut off her hair because of what did she get, lice or something? Some kind of infestation that's caused inadvertently by Sarah.
Huh. Oh yeah, that's right too. Well, there's all kinds of, well, nanobots or something in issue two that get brought up. I enjoyed it. That's it. Yeah. She, in my mind, I think she cut it. Well, I don't know why she cut it. It's what you said. It's either infestation or she decided, you know what? Nobody's pulling my hair again.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it. It was, you know, like as far as a horror thriller thing goes, you know, it's definitely got visceral beats that are gross. And I, you know, it's intriguing enough that I want to know. And I think it's only four issues, from what I recall.
So I might be mistaken. Year, John and Juan will come out with their fourth issue of Scratcher
and tie it up somehow.
But yeah, I mean, this is an intriguing horror series. It's fun, set in the world of D, this tattoo artist.
Yeah,
and who would have thunk, tattooing, hey. Tattoo parlor.
I mean, I've heard you can get a disease or something if they don't sanitize their needles right. But this is a little off the rails.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is interesting. So, yeah, definitely check out John's website.
Mm-hmm.
Arbutus? Yeah, I've been pronouncing it.
I say Arbutus because that's a town outside of Baltimore.
Arbutusfilms.com, Arbutus, films.com. And then you'll see a link there to, among other things, his comic Scratcher.
Yeah. And I agree with you. I hadn't even thought of that, but you know, it is kind of like a variation on like a werewolf story and a variation on like a vampire story. And I think it's a really interesting take on those things.
Yeah. And the way that he's setting this up apparently is that what happens in one issue of Scratcher doesn't necessarily have anything to do with what happens in the other issue. So for instance, in the world, in the things that happen in the first issue of Scratcher, we don't see the after effects in Scratcher issue two or Scratcher number three or part three. They're not calling it a number, it's part. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, you know, if you want to get the comics, you can get actually from his site, which he calls Comics Central. So if you go to the main page and then click on, you know, Comics Central, then you can find that you can buy each of the first three issues digitally from John. And apparently Comics Central, I guess, is a actual comic shop.
Mm-hmm. That looks like it.
Yeah. So that's cool. He's a shop owner among other things. Wow. Mm-hmm. A physicist and a shop owner.
Hey, I'm telling you.
Or you can get the first two issues digitally through Comixology.
Mm-hmm. That's what I was going to add, but you got it.
Yeah. You can also get it for Kindle.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're related, I think, because Comixology and Amazon are they're the same. They're everywhere.
So there you go. We began by looking at now number five, edited by Eric Reynolds, coming out from Fantagraphics, another wonderful anthological collection from the good folks at Fantagraphics. That followed up with a discussion of Criminal Number One by Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips, of course, coming out from Image. And then we wrapped up with a self-published comic, Scratcher, issue 1 through 3, written by John Ward with art by Juan Romero. And again, we told you where to find it. Go there and check it out and see not only John's strange storytelling, but also Juan's really nice art. We didn't talk much about the art, but I think it's worth mentioning that Juan Romero is an impressive artist.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. You know, he does the commonplace, he does the horrific. He's got a really good sense of storytelling, which I enjoyed.
Yeah. So I had a good time talking about these titles, and if you want to find great titles like this, then you would do well to check out the site of our sponsor, which is Discount Comic Book Service. Remember, go to dcbservice.com. They will take care of all of your comics pre-ordering needs, a great place to get your comics.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and if you look now, I didn't say this on the front end, but on the back end, they have 3 trades of Criminal series, all for 40% off if you want to catch up on some of that backstory.
Yeah, catch up on your criminal storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And then after you do that, contact us and let us know what you're going to be reading. If you go to our website, comicsalternative.com, you'll find that you could leave us a voice message online via SpeakPipe. Or you can contact us the old-fashioned way by picking up your phone and dialing 415-3-COMICS. That's 415-326-6427.
Or if you prefer to email us, you can email us at twoguys@comicsalternative.com. Or if you just want to email me, I'm Sturge@comicsalternative.com.
And I'm Derek at comicsalternative.com. You can also reach us via social media. We have accounts on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, Instagram, Google+, Goodreads, Pinterest, YouTube, Slack, and Discord. You can subscribe to the podcast through Apple Podcasts. You can stream us on Stitcher. You can also find us on Spotify, on TuneIn, on iHeartRadio, and on Google Podcasts. But you can find every single one of our podcast episodes, as well as the reviews and comics-related commentary that we post on our blog, simply by going to the website, which is comicsalternative.com.
That's right. We're everywhere. We're also everywhere.
Yeah. And not in a strange, creepy way.
Oh, not in a bad Big Brother way, like a hip Big Brother that lets you borrow his record albums and cool comic books.
And we will be back next week with another review show. Until then, I'm Derek.
And I'm Sturge.
Take care.
Peace.